Hi, I'm Elise.
I'm Matt, and welcome to Pod Wraiths, a Star Trek Deep Space Nine podcast. If this is your first time joining us, we're two friends watching Star Trek Deep Space Nine and sharing both our deep and irreverent thoughts on our favorite Star Trek series.
This week, we're talking about Season 4, Episode 24, The Quickening, teleplay by Naren Shankar and directed by Rene Auberjonois. The Quickening aired on May 20th, 1996.
This week on Deep Space Nine, Dr. Bashir works to rid a planet of a plague that was sent by the Dominion as punishment for resistance. Well, we'll start this episode the same way we do most episodes. Elise, did you or did you not remember this episode?
I did not remember this episode except for the cold open, which I didn't remember was like only a cold open or like a short scene. Like in my mind, it was like a B plot or something of an episode. And clearly it was like a few seconds. That being said, I'm super glad that we have this little bit of quirk comedy at the start of the episode because, man, is this a depressing and dark episode otherwise.
Kind of does a weird tone shift, though, there. That it starts, it's like, come to Quarks, Quarks is fun. Come to Quarks, don't walk, run.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it's like, let's talk about mutual or
assisted suicide.
medical assistance in dying.
I mean, maybe. I don't know if this guy's a doctor, but so I'm going to say assisted suicide. But back to Quark real quick. I absolutely love that my little capitalist baby has found ways to advertise on Deep Space Nine and on the Defiant. Like, I just want to see that. A comic book version of like Quark sneaking onto the Defiant in order to program the replicators to do this. Like, that is something I would love to read. And I feel like a comic book would be perfect for it.
I still, to this day, would like one of those. I mean, like any of the mugs, like the Ractogeno mugs that come on, you know, for other replicators. But I think the Quarks one would be fun, and it doesn't have to play the jingle. That's fine. Just, you know, whatever. But this is the level of like freak I kind of am. I know the like portrait of Quark that's on that mug is obviously like was taken in like a season one promo photo or something because his nose is the old nose.
Yep. Yeah.
It just looks so weird.
I didn't notice that, but I did read that online while I was doing some notes. But I'm going to choose to believe that you just remembered it on your own.
I didn't have time to look up the notes.
No,
this week.
I'm completely joking with you. Of course, I think that you just knew that. I just like to accuse people of cheating, apparently. The other thing I enjoy about this episode is that we get a Bashir and Dax team up. That's fun. I guess. Normally it's fun. I don't think I would call anything that happens in this episode fun, except for the Quark stuff.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of interesting, because, like, this episode in some ways is kind of similar-ish to Hippocratic Oath, which was earlier this season, and that was a Bashir and O'Brien team up, and now we get Dax. It's like, that's well, who they team yeah. Bashir up with.
It's
either
funny,
Dax or O'Brien.
And it's funny, because Renee directed both of those episodes.
Oh, that is funny.
And I think both of them were like filmed out of order. When I was reading up on this episode, I wanted to call out that at first it kind of started as an AIDS allegory. Greg Duffy Long, who I guess was an office assistant that everyone knew, I don't know specifically if that person worked on the show, probably. Had just died of AIDS. And so Iris Stephen Bear, he said his wife was working closely with the AIDS project of like Los Angeles. And so it was something that was on their minds. The only thing is they ended up switching that when writing the show because all of these folks that were working on the show were like, oh, AIDS patients are usually ostracized, like they're lepers or something, and which is another group that gets ostracized. And we don't think that our community in this episode is going to be that way. So they kind of dropped that allegory.
Kept the lesions, though.
Yeah, they did kept the lesions. The lesions are definitely a lot.
Yeah, like, the episode definitely goes more kind of, or at least to me, a little more if we're talking about, like, you know, plague-like diseases is a little bit more like Black Death in that sense where, like, it's ever, like, people change their society and acknowledge the ever-presentness of us and, like, this, that whole idea, like, the medieval kind of motif that, like, I still very much am into. Hell, I kind of have a tattoo kind of based on this, but the idea of, like, memento mori and, like, the good death and, you know, memories and just the ever-presentness of death, and, like, the dance macabre and, like, all that sort of stuff. Like, it's definitely giving more of that than it is of, you know, any kind of AIDS or queer allegory. It's just in one level, for me, it's kind of frustrating that it kind of just developed probably naturally from their perspective, like, away from that, because it's like 80s and 90s Trek is always kind of like flirting with, you know, like, well, AIDS specifically, they wanted to do one on TNG and then got scared off it, and like queer allegories in general in this area of Star Trek, and it's like they want to but they don't, they back out. It's like, oh, this is a good idea, and then like even like I was like, oh, this would be a good idea, we should do something like this, and then, you know, he is too busy working on other things and like gives it to Naren. It is what it is, and I'm not gonna get my like one get too up in a knot about it. It's just, you know, a little disappointing. But like, what I will say is the perception of perceiving people living with HIV or AIDS patients as kind of outcasts or pariahs, like, just feels like a very straight community perception of like the AIDS crisis to me, because it just like it's extenuated the ways in which queer folks were like ostracized, but then like within the community, and again, no community is like a monolith, but it's like there was a lot of rallying around patients and getting involved in, you know, ACT UP or like AIDS Project Los Angeles and all of those things. The idea that like for it to be like an AIDS allegory, they have to be like, there has to be like homophobia or queerphobia in the world.
I see
where they're coming from, but it's kind of
I get what you're saying. It's like very, they're treating it as like these people are the worst of the queers, like, and that, you know what I mean? Like, it's just, it's gross. But I guess I do wonder if they didn't come to that conclusion, if we would have gotten something more offensive, so who knows?
I mean, yeah, like a good example of that, there's that Next Generation episode, The Outcast, where they like tried to make it kind of like an episode about like homosexuality, and actually they backed into like a fairly good, like, I wouldn't say good, a fairly interesting and not as problematic as you would think for the time representation of like gender queerness, right? So they're like, and again, a lot of people still confuse gender and sexuality, but they wanted to make it about sexuality, and they actually made something kind of interesting about like, you know, gender queerness or transness or whatever, and they totally fell ass backwards into that one. But I get what you mean. I hate the ending of The Outcast. Fuck the ending of The Outcast. Yeah. Anyways. It's actually giving kind of a similar... this ending isn't as offensive to me as the ending of The Outcast, but it is doing that, like, the kind of, like... There's more hope in this ending than there is in The Outcast, but it's doing the, like... We're still gonna undercut that with sadness.
Yeah. There is one other thing I wanted to mention before we get into it. The actor who plays Trevian, which is like their euthanasia guy, Michael Sarrazin, he is known for playing, I guess he was in a movie called They Shoot Horses, Don't They, from 1969, and he helps his character helps the other character played by Jane Fonda like die, which is very interesting that they basically have him doing the same thing in this show. I've not seen that movie.
Yeah, it's on my list. It's been on my list for a while. Especially since listening to the was it the Joan and Jane season of You Must Remember This? I think it's a Sydney Pollack movie.
I have actually not listened to that season of You Must Remember This.
Yeah, what it does, just as for context for the listeners, is it's kind of like it's a little bit of a parallel biographies between Jane Fonda and Jean Seberg, and the ways in which kind of they were similar in, being actresses emerging at the same time and having, far left or fairly leftist revolutionary politics, and then kind of tracking their careers through that. And of course, yeah, one career is still going, and the other one died a while ago. So, there's definitely kind of a divergent path there, but
I
yeah,
just
Jean
wanted
Seberg
to.
was quite involved with the Black Panthers,
Oh,
so
interesting. I wanted
yeah.
to confirm with you that you were right. It is a Sydney Pollack movie.
Nice.
Good job. So.
I can't not think, sorry, this
No,
is an
yes,
aside,
please.
but
No, yeah.
whenever we think about Sydney Pollack, I cannot think about Eyes Wide Shut, because he's a supporting actor in that, and that's the
Yeah.
part that oh, what's his nuts, got fired off of Harvey Keitel because he and Kubrick didn't get along. Oh, anyways,
I've only seen that movie once. I very much need to see it again. But I
wait,
recently.
did I bring it up last week when we talked about Barry Lyndon?
I don't remember if
Was
you
that you I was
mentioned.
talking to about Barry Lyndon and
Yeah, we
candles and Christmas lights?
definitely talked about Barry Lyndon because it was there was a scene in the episode that they were basing on that.
Okay, yeah, no, this is the second week in a row I have with a brought up Eyes Wide Shut and Stanley Kubrick.
Okay, but I
All
also
right,
wanted to
cool.
say that Sydney Pollack has done some of my favorite movies. I love The Way We Were. And I even like the remake of Sabrina. But there's a lot of movies of his I have not seen that I need to watch still. That's all on Sydney
Yeah, the
Pollack.
thing about the Sabrina remake, and again, I haven't seen it, but makes it an intellectual curiosity for me, is it's a lot of people, even before that movie, compared Harrison Ford to Bogart, and it's like he's the Bogart character in that,
Yep,
right?
he is.
Yeah,
He
so.
I will admit to it came out in 1995, and I did not see the original film first, which is surprising because I grew up on a lot of Billy Wilder films, but I had not seen that one. And it's actually originally a play called Sabrina Fair, but I think it is such a good remake. They make them kind of like an investment company. It's really good. Oh, Nancy Marchand plays the mom.
Oh, there you go. There you go.
It has, real quick, also Greg Kinnear and Lauren Holly are both in it as well, and Julia Ormond.
Whatever happened to Greg Kinnear?
I was gonna be like he died, but as a joke, and that's probably not funny.
Anyways, and listeners, if you know what happened to Greg Kinnear, email us at podrace@gmail.com.
Oh, he was in three episodes of the show You last year. Oh,
Oh, he's still getting
he
work.
played Atticus Finch in a stage production on Broadway of To Kill a Mockingbird 2 years ago. So I count that as
Well,
working.
there you go. He's working. Good for Greg. Unless he's a jerk that I don't know about, then in case I take it back, because this is going up on the internet forever, so I have to cover my bases. All of this diatribe to say, Ira Stephen Baird, drop your letterbox handle. You are such a little cinephile, baby.
Yes,
Like, what's your letterbox? I want to follow you.
yes. It's like, please follow Martin Scorsese and let us follow you.
See, maybe we don't know what his letterbox is because he doesn't have a daughter who's Gen Z, to my knowledge.
Speaking of someone who is a Speaking of another famous person who's on Letterboxd, I'm obsessed with Ayo Edebiri's Letterboxd. Obsessed. best reviews ever.
Ireland's finest.
Yeah. That's about the type of comedy you will get on AO's Letterboxd, actually. So good.
But also, Francesca Scorsese, if you're listening to this, I want to meet your dad. So if you can help me out with that, that'd be great.
I love it. Okay. So, okay, I just need everyone to know that while we're discussing this, I'm also copying and pasting Io Edebiri's favorite films into the chat for Matt to see while we're talking. Anyway. Dax, Bashir, and Kira are on a bio survey mission, and they find a distress call, and so they go to check things out, and they find this population of people who are sick and have lesions all over themselves. We basically find a society that runs as half hospice, half assisted suicide program, or maybe one-third hospice, one-third assisted suicide, and one-third, like, anxiety over not knowing if you're going to die any minute. Yeah, it's a lot. The disease that they have, which they just call the blight or whatever, which I don't know, like, I don't like that word and I don't know why. It basically just means disease, so it's just weird that they're calling it that. Like they couldn't be bothered to name the disease that they've had for all this time, I guess. Actually, we never really find out how long they've had it, because the Jem'Hadar gave it to them because they were trying to resist the Dominion's rule. But they don't know. It's unclear, like, how many generations this has gone on. Do they say?
Well, it's been a minute. Well, I think there's something about 200 years. They get called there because it's like there's an automated distress signal that's like in the aftermath of the attack. And then I think there's some line that like the thing has just been running itself for like a couple centuries.
Yeah, it reminds me of the distress call in Lost that Danielle puts up. But like for longer, I guess.
Somewhere beyond the sea. Somewhere waiting for me. En français.
Oh, I got you. Danielle. I love how Saeed says her name. So then once the disease becomes like active or quickens, that's like when you're like, oh no, the quickening is happening. The quickening sounds to me like it should be a horror movie title.
Well, and I guess that idea of like the virus or whatever it is being in stages also is like you can see the like DNA of the AIDS allegory that they abandoned, right? Because it's like you're HIV positive and then it, you know, becomes AIDS.
Exactly. I did read up that this guy, Trevann, the one who is the person that gives the terminally ill folks their painless way to die. Trevann is an anagram of veteran, which I thought was very silly. But the writer had said she did that to, like, put something cute in there, I guess.
I mean, yeah, fair enough.
Sorry.
Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say the fact that they do this is something that is so shocking to Bashir and Dax in a way that felt like unbelievable since Dax like 300 years old.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? Cuz it's like whenever Star Trek does something like this, it's always interesting when their characters respond in a very kind of, for lack of a better word or my bias, like an unevolved, un-24th or 23rd century sort of way, where it's like you can see the like content. And this is why one of the interesting things about the podcast, like the context or the morality of the time it was produced coming through, where it's like, oh my God, like why would you do this? And again, I would hope there'd be a different like medication or whatever that Trevelyan could use, because when that one guy's having the nice dinner with his family, and you know, I totally
did
all
you
get
call
that.
Him
and
Trevelyan
then
just now, which is
Trevelyan or whatever. Yeah, Alec Trevelyan.
Yes.
Yeah, Sean Bean, 006.
Franklin James,
the Cossack himself.
Sorry, I just couldn't let that go.
No, that's fine.
Hashtag golden
doesn't exactly
eye.
Look like a painless death. It's quick.
It's like some herbs or something.
Couldn't do some like nice lethal injection shit.
Yeah.
Like, fuck.
Yeah. He basically gave them like a blunt or something.
Yeah. It's like very like, oh no, like physician assisted euthanasia. Oh yeah. No, this is some more like, and like, again, I mean, we can or can't.
I have always been in support of this. Dying with dignity. It's a good thing.
I would agree. There you go. We don't have to discuss it.
Yeah, that's why I was like, what if we just say our opinions on it and we both agree and then we can just move on.
Yeah, it's like one of those things, like the older I get, it's like the release or whatever they talk about, like in The Giver, which is like very much like this.
Yes.
I was like, is that such a bad thing? Is it supposed to be so shocking?
I know, I have to buy a new car. I need to like save money for this. I need to save money for that. And I'm just like, I can't. And then my brain shuts down and I'm just like, I don't want to make choices anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh God. I forgot about The Giver until you just said that. One thing I do like that they do in this society, because everyone kind of knows when you're about to die, they have these like death celebrations. And actually the one guy was like kind of bummed that later in the episode he's like, you've ruined my death party, basically. And it's because he's like,
yeah,
gonna try to like get healed. I just think that's nice. It's important to tell our loved ones that we love them before they die, and just spending time together is really cool. Spending time with your friends is cool. That was such a corny thing to say.
It's just like the intentionality around it, right?
Yes.
Like,
yeah,
it's true. Like, we call, often you'll see like a funeral or whatever called like a celebration of life to be held after blah 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 blah.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's not that, but it's like, what kind of a special thing to have that with the person, right? Like,
yeah. Yeah.
That doesn't make the loss for the people like left behind like any easier. Like, you know, and you're still like going through grief and like all of that. But yeah, I just think it's kind of cool.
Yeah, agree. One thing I think this episode does really well, for me, was kind of introducing a new character that we know we're never gonna see these people again, but I found Ikoria, who is a brand new character that we've never met, like, very easy to like and to root for. I instantly cared about, like, what happened to her story, which is not something that happens to me a lot when watching a lot of these episodes, unless it's a character that's, like, staying around. Mm-hmm. And I think part of it was just how much hope she had. I do think it was a bit tropey for, like, the one person who's the mother-to-be to be like, oh, I'm hopeful for the future. Like, that, obviously, you're about to have a kid and you don't want your kid to die. That makes sense.
Yeah.
But it still worked for me. And I was reading up on this, and Renee had said that he felt that the way that Ikoria was written in the episode kind of had, like, some Virgin Mary vibes to it. You know, she's like, I mean, obviously she's not a virgin and her husband had died, but just like how she was like this one hope, basically. And I thought that was kind of interesting, but also something I don't know a lot about.
Talk about Elise's favorite thing, Christian symbolism. You have here in the notes too from the Deep Space Nine Companion that Renee was like, we tried to do sort of like a Vermeer thing look to it. Vermeer being the Dutch, I think it's actually Baroque, so like later on Renaissance Baroque period, Dutch artist who like folks, you know, the girl with the pearl earring, that
yes.
painting?
Yes, yes, yes.
That's Vermeer.
Got it. I'm
maybe not be saying it properly, but whatever. So, and like, once you do that, I was kind of looking at some of his other artwork before we recorded, and some of like the colors and like the tones and stuff like that, I can definitely see in like her house and her costuming and like everything else. So,
nice.
Yeah, I get it. It's like the idea of like, you know,
what if
hope for salvation within the like, you know.
Mm-hmm. I was just thinking,
like, you know, pregnant woman, like First Reformed kind of does the same thing on a smaller scale with Amanda Seyfried's character, right. But isn't her actual name fucking Mary in that too? Anyways,
I don't remember what her name was. I only watched it the one time, but I was just thinking how funny it would be if remember the year where the Met Gala theme was basically like Catholics or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
What if it was like the quickening, but like the Met Gala theme? Like, how sad would that be? I appreciate the silence because there's literally nothing that can be said to what I just said because it was so stupid.
No. It wasn't. I mean, it wasn't stupid. No, I just. I don't know. The Met Gala. Some themes rule. Other ones are like. I'm still annoyed about the camp one where it's like.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like. You can't. Intentionally, this is why I hated Cocaine Bear. Anyways, we're way off topic now.
I have not seen Cocaine Bear, but this is something that I would like to hear about another time.
We need to free Carrie Russell from like whatever prison her agent has put her in her post-Americans career. It's just like that. Anyways, the other thing that I thought of that came out, you know, like 10 years later after this episode, another example of, you know, the hope through the like singular like pregnant woman was Children of Men, right? Yeah. So this episode in some ways has some Children of Men vibes. Again, I don't remember when the novel came out. I'm gonna look that up now.
Right. I will say that Children of Men was a bit more stressful for me to watch than this episode. If I recall correctly, I'm just kidding. I'm reading a quote from what I wrote in my review. I said, I need a massage now after watching Children of Men.
Yeah. So Children of Men, the novel, came out in 92.
Okay.
So.
You should write like a... That reminded me of something that I came up with of three different James Bond films that have a connection to them that have nothing to do with this. That I want to talk to you about later.
Diamonds Are Forever.
Speaking That's not involved.
Problematic. Speaking of problematic queer rep that actually yes. kind of rules.
Yeah. Yeah, those guys.
Be gay, do crime.
Yeah.
Kill James Bond.
So on this planet, Bashir's plan is to map the virus and try to create a cure. The biggest challenge being that, like, no one wants to volunteer for, like, a scan. They're, like, living their lives. They're having their death parties. They don't want to be bothered with this because they've been promised a cure before. They've been promised help before. And I appreciate that, of course, Julian, who we love, is going to say, well, I'm not making any promises. They're always going to have our hero say that so that if something good happens, there were no promises made. Sorry, I meant if something bad happens.
Yeah. No, but like he also says that, but then like his actions don't necessarily follow that. And it's like, right. I don't know, his whole like God complex is just
it's too much. And I like that Dax calls him.
It's giving we talked about Lost earlier, but it's giving Jack
Shepard. yeah. He's so upset that it's, you know, he's not, because I mean I'm getting ahead of it, but like things are going well and then it takes a turn. And their EM fields and their tools are what are making the blight quicken. So their tools are like...
Which is also... He's making it worse that actually is giving Jack Shepard.
Yeah, that's true. He has better bedside manner, though, if I'm going to be honest.
Touche.
So he's feeling really sorry for himself that he didn't figure this out. And Dax is like, well, there's no way you would have known that. But he's so arrogant that he is convinced that there can't be a cure because he didn't find it. No one else can do this work but him. And I really liked that she said that to his face. She's such a good friend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've talked about this before, but like since they like gave up on the him being a sex pest tour thing, I really like them as a dramatic pairing in the episodes.
Yeah, they're really good at like telling each other the truth, and I think that's important. There was a lot of Bashir feeling sorry for himself, which I get, and I'd probably feel the same way that he did, but like that part kind of bored me. In the episode, I was just like, I don't need to see him be like a sad sap. Like, it was fine. We get a little bit of good news, I guess, at the end. Akoria had her health started deteriorating and the quickening started and they were trying to have her hold on for a couple more weeks because it would be better for the baby. And they did some tests on her, and the antigen wasn't in her body at all, so they just assumed that her body rejected it. But eventually, she gives birth, and her baby doesn't have the disease, and has no lesions at all. So they realize that it must have absorbed into the placenta. Those are just words that I know. I don't know what any of that means. If you're pregnant and you get this medicine, your baby should be okay.
Supposedly. Yeah, so the placenta, folks might remember, is an organ that develops in the uterus during pregnancy. It's kind of like where the connection is, like where the umbilical cord comes out of. And then it gets, typically I think it's passed as well, like during the birth. So yes. Yeah, it's tied to kind of like the nutrients and the antibodies, and it's where like it removes waste products from the baby's blood and blah 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 blah. So like, yeah, provides oxygen to the fetus. So yeah,
placentas.
So they're a thing. Some people eat them.
Oh yeah, people do, like that's some like Gwyneth Paltrow shit, right?
Probably. I think, you know, it's more common in kind of some Asian cultures historically too, and like others, but like I couldn't give you like
got it
a whole list of like who does and why and whatever. Well,
I'm sorry if I offended anyone's culture. Not to Gwyneth Paltrow.
Well, I don't know how common it is now, but yeah, it's definitely
Gwyneth Paltrow doesn't have any culture besides being a snake oil salesman. To me.
So I guess, Elise, the question I have remaining for you is, did you like this episode?
I don't know. Like, I didn't rewatch it a second time, if that tells you anything. Sometimes I power through and do it anyway, but I knew that rewatching it would make me really sad. And I just was already going to be sad talking about it.
Yeah.
That's why I probably make more, like, stupid jokes when it's a sadder episode, because I'm, like, trying to cheer us up.
Yeah, no, that's fair. That's fair. Okay, how does this episode compare to you from, like, Hippocratic Oath, which was at the start of the season? We're kind of nearing the end now. They're kind of very similar-ish, kind of in, you know, the problem that Julian has to solve. I know this is going back like
several months. I have an answer like, for you.
Which would you prefer and why?
I like Hippocratic Oath better. I think it actually wrestles with the moral issue at hand way more than this episode does. O'Brien and Bashir are having that argument almost most of the episode on whether he should be helping them or not and giving their different reasons why they should and shouldn't. And in this episode, you know, Dax and Bashir are outraged, and obviously they work to try to make it so the euthanasia doesn't have to happen. But there's not, like, a really big debate between the two populations that feels getting into it at all, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. Yeah. And I just, like, kind of hate how, like, this episode is framed as, like, a medical assistance in dying is bad, and so we need to cure this, the quickening, just so, you know, we remove, like, euthanasia. Like, but again, that's all feels like very 90s of it. And, like, Alora does want to live and, like, doesn't want to go through, like, you know what I mean? So, like, I get it. Like, oh, I'm not saying don't cure the disease, like,
right.
But the impetus for it is, like, just this, like,
yeah,
moral outrage at Maid, and it's just, like, yeah.
The episode actually had a different title at first, and I can't remember what it was now, but they changed it because the original title, hold on, implied that Julian was completely successful in what he was trying to do in the episode, and they felt that that gave, like, a false a version of what was going to happen in the episode, so they changed it to the quickening.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, now that we've had a nice pregnant pause and we've let that all, you know, collect, it's time to do a complete 180. It's time now for the Altair Water Thirst Quencher. Altair Water first being mentioned by Dr. McCoy in Star Trek 3, possibly also being a reference to Alta from Altair 4 in Forbidden Planet. Elise, are you finding time for some thirst in amongst these real heavy topics this week?
I'm almost bummed that you didn't do that transition by just saying, and now for something completely different.
Oh, next time, next time, next time.
I did not find any storyline in this to be very thirsty at all, but I will say, and I know I already talked about this, but when Dax tells Julian basically that he's being arrogant for assuming that since he didn't find a cure, that there isn't one, I was like, this is hot. I want this woman to step on me. I love her.
Yeah, I didn't really have, like, a thirst candidate for this week. Yeah. I guess maybe it's Quark's generosity in that the mug that Worf brought in earlier, it said, return to Quark's for one free refill. And it's like, oh, Quark's giving away drinks as part of the promo. That's very altruistic of him. I did have a candidate for most Star Trek thing. I've already alluded to it earlier. Star Trek Doctor cures the thing. We've even seen it with this very Doctor earlier in the season, as aforementioned.
Yeah. This is not really a most Star Trek thing, but I didn't know where else to put it. But I just wish that the like little blurb at the beginning with Quark and his advertisements, I wish that was the episode. Like, I wanted the gag to be like the whole thing,
and it's about truth and advertising or something.
Sure.
Well, until next time, Elise, where can folks find more of you on the internet?
Yes, you can find me on Blue Sky, Letterbox, and Storygraph at Chicken Tendi. That's T-N-D-I. You can find my other podcast, Fang Bangers Pod, on Blue Sky and Instagram at Fang Bangers Pod. That's bangers with a Z or Z, as well as anywhere you listen to podcasts. I think when this episode airs, we will have just finished season 2 of True Blood.
Hoo-hoo-hoo. Very exciting. And you can find me on Letterboxd, Blue Sky, and sometimes Twitter, at Mattyhugh, M-A-T-T-Y-H-U-G-H. You can catch us together on Blue Sky and Instagram at PodRace, and you can email us at podrace@gmail.com.
Please remember to rate and review us on the podcatching system of your choice. Thank you again to our editor, Melissa, and DJ Empirical for our interstellar theme song.
And until next time, computer and program.
Bye.